This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, March 21st, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, U.S. President Barack Obama meets with the Palestinian president and addresses students in Israel as human rights advocates call for concrete steps in the Mideast peace process. House lawmakers narrowly passed the Paul Ryan budget. The plan seeks to approve the Keystone XL pipeline, but activists in Canada and across the U.S. are fighting the tar sands project. And we'll go to Argentina, where domestic workers just won a victory in their fight for better working conditions. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The Indian Parliament today approved new anti-rape legislation to tackle the high incidence of sexual violence against women. The new law comes in response to national outrage over the gang rape of a 23-year-old woman in New Delhi last year. FSRN's Bismillah Gilani reports.
The upper house of the parliament passed the criminal law amendment, but only after the lower chamber diluted some of its provisions. Lawmakers took out changes that would have required life imprisonment for acid attacks and lowering the age of sexual consent from 18 to 16. Contrary to the popular demand, the law proposes death penalty for rape only in cases involving extreme violence. In all other cases, the punishment is 20 years in prison. The law also suggests specific punishments for crimes like stalking and voyeurism and seeks to improve enforcement by requiring police to open a case when an assault is reported. The legislation draws hugely on the recommendations of a government panel set up in response to public outcry over last year's Delhi gang rape. It, however, ignores some of the panel's key recommendations, including the one criminalizing marital rape. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Russian officials have been conducting an unprecedented wave of investigations over the past few weeks involving hundreds of non-governmental organizations. Some NGOs say the government is targeting them because they receive financing from abroad. Today, a human rights group in Moscow with ties to USAID became the latest target. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
Government officials made a surprise visit today to the International Human Rights Organization Memorial. Yulia Klimova, the group's press secretary, said the officials demanded to see their financial and incorporation documents.
We can't say why there is suddenly a necessity for these unplanned inspections. It's probably connected with the law and NGOs as foreign agents. It's the first reason that comes to mind.
Under the law that went into effect last November, Russian NGOs that receive support from abroad must register as foreign agents. Memorial and several other groups are refusing to register. Today, the Presidential Human Rights Council appealed to the General Prosecutor, asking him to explain the investigation. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, Russia.
Canadian lawmakers passed a bill last night to formally include transgender people for the first time in federal human rights protections. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has the story from Montreal.
The bill passed the House of Commons Wednesday night with a 149-137 vote. The legislation adds transgender people to the Canadian Human Rights Act and Criminal Code, which offer protections against discrimination. The bill gained support from 18 members of the ruling Conservative Party, but Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper voted against it. The organization Queer Ontario hailed the passage as a step in the right direction, but expressed concern that the phrase gender expression had been dropped from the original legislation. Organizers say they'd like to see broad legal protections for all forms of gender expression. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
A federal judge in Georgia has issued a permanent injunction blocking part of the state's controversial Arizona-inspired immigration law. The judge ruled Wednesday a provision that punishes people who knowingly transport or harbor undocumented immigrants is preempted by federal law. Despite this, lawmakers in Georgia are considering a measure to expand the reach of the state's immigration law by denying many immigrants access to utilities, marriage certificates, and municipal buildings requiring ID, according to the Georgia ACLU. The bill passed the State House on Monday. Today, civil rights advocates, faith leaders, and state lawmakers held a press conference outside the Capitol in Atlanta, announcing their opposition to the legislation. An appeals court in New York is hearing a case today concerning the authority of municipalities to restrict oil and gas drilling. Several communities in the state are embroiled in the controversy over fracking, and more than 50 towns have banned the practice, according to the AP. The rural town of Dryden passed a zoning ordinance in 2011 prohibiting oil and gas drilling. An oil company sued, saying the state's Department of Environmental Conservation has the authority to make the decision, not the community. Town Supervisor Mary Ann Sumner says Dryden residents are concerned about the environment.
Do we have that choice, or will we leave it to people in corporate offices thousands of miles away who know nothing about our lifestyle?
Initially, a judge ruled in the town's favor, but the ruling is being appealed by a Norway-based oil company. Harvard Law School's Sean Goho says the court's ruling won't be binding on other states in a strict legal sense, but could set a marker.
There are real local concerns at stake here, not just regarding the local impacts of fracking, but also about local government's interest in protecting their traditional zoning powers. And in that sense, cities and towns all across the country will be watching the outcome of this case.
The appellate division is expected to hand down a decision in late April or May. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. President Obama continued his Mideast trip today with public addresses in both Israel and the West Bank. In Ramallah, during a joint press conference with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, Obama said Palestinians deserve an end to the occupation and a state of their own.
If given the chance, one thing that I'm very certain of is that the Palestinians have the talent, the drive, and the courage to succeed in their own state. I think of the villages that hold peaceful protests because they understand the moral force of nonviolence. I think of the importance that Palestinian families place on education. I think of the entrepreneurs determined to create something new, like the young Palestinian woman I met at the entrepreneurship summit that I hosted, who wants to build recreation centers for Palestinian youth. I think of the aspirations that so many young Palestinians have for their future, which is why I'm looking forward to visiting with some of them right after we conclude this press conference. That's why we can't give up.
On the streets of Ramallah and other West Bank cities, some Palestinians continued protesting Obama's visit. Many say the U.S. government should come out more strongly against Israel's human rights abuses, as well as settlement expansion, especially the area known as E1, which would divide the West Bank. At the press conference, Abbas was resolute that settlement expansion must end before negotiations of a two-state solution.
Regarding the issue of settlements, it is not only our perception that settlements are illegal, but it is a global perspective. Everybody considers settlements not only a hurdle, but even more than a hurdle towards a two-state solution.
Shortly after, in Jerusalem, President Obama addressed university students at the International Convention Center. Outside of an interruption by a heckler, the crowd of mostly young Israelis enthusiastically responded to Obama's statements about the U.S. friendship with Israel and to his emphasis on Palestinian people's right to self-determination and justice.
Palestinians have a right to be a free people in their own land. You know, I'm going off script here for a second, but before I came here, I met with a group of young Palestinians from the age of 15 to 22. And talking to them, they weren't that different from my daughters. They weren't that different from your daughters or sons. I honestly believe that if any Israeli parent sat down with those kids, they'd say, I want these kids to succeed. I want them to prosper. I want them to have opportunities just like my kids do. I believe that's what Israeli parents would want for these kids if they had a chance to listen to them and talk to them. I believe that.
Obama also told the crowd that political leaders will never take risks if people do not push them to take some risks. Despite the high-profile visit by President Obama, many human rights groups say a change to Israel's policies toward the occupied territories, from the arrest and treatment of detainees to moving the peace process forward, must come from within the country. For more, we're joined by Hadass Ziv, Public Outreach Director for Physicians for Human Rights in Israel. That's a non-governmental nonprofit group that provides medical and humanitarian assistance to detainees and refugees. Hadass Ziv joins us from Tel Aviv. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
In his speech today, President Obama renewed calls for peace talks and for a two-state solution, but he stopped short of calling for a halt to settlement expansion in the West Bank. Your reaction to his speech?
The reaction is, we'll wait and see. I'm a generation that had lots of hopes and lots of disappointments, and I think that the illusion that someone from the outside can change the situation is not healthy for us as an Israeli public. I think that the change will only come if we realize that we want it and that we can achieve it. So I think, yes, the help of President Obama is much appreciated. I think, however, that he's usually too friendly to Israel and sometimes more pressure is needed, maybe. But truly, let's see.
Your group runs mobile clinics that go out into Palestinian villages, including places like Bilin, where residents have been fighting the construction of the wall. How does what you see on the ground compare to how President Obama or other political leaders describe the situation?
I think that they don't see into the details, maybe. And the details is where the disappointment and desperation lies. They don't see the people who are fighting and fighting and fighting, and see that all they hear is about, especially from the Israeli side, you don't have the leadership to carry on a peace process. You give nothing where they feel that they have nothing, let alone give something. So I think that sometimes when you look from afar or when you look at the global processes, you lose the contact with the simple people who pay the price daily. And sometimes this distorts the picture.
Some of those details come out in the cases of Palestinian prisoners and detainees. Your group has condemned the recent death of Palestinian prisoner Arafat Jaradat, whose body showed signs of torture. Talk about the treatment of Palestinian prisoners held by Israeli officials, especially ones held under administrative detention orders, and the ongoing hunger strike also in detention facilities in Israel.
Okay, I think that the death of Jaradat is yet to be seen. We asked for an objective investigation of how it came about. But our experience of decades working with Palestinian prisoners and detainees is that people don't realize how big an issue it is for the families and the society they come from. People also see them as sometimes criminals, sometimes as the worst terrorists we've ever been faced with, etc., etc. So the hunger strike was not given enough attention within the Israeli public. People didn't see it for what it was. It was like a last resort of people that are desperate to be acknowledged and recognized as people who are fighting for the people who are struggling. And I think that the minute the Israeli public will realize that prisoners are part of the deal. Prisoners were always and will always be part of a process whereby reconciliation or peace or talks or negotiation will ever be achieved. And as long as we just shove them away and keep on ignoring their rights and keep on ignoring their crucial role in their own society, I think that this is part of the thing. We don't see them. We don't see the Palestinians. They are transparent to us.
You spoke a moment ago about how change must come from within Israeli society. Of course, in the U.S. media, you know, there's a lot of attention on President Obama in the region. One aspect of U.S. policy towards Israel that that could potentially have a big impact is U.S. Support for Israeli military and U.S. military aid going to Israel. As physicians, what have you seen about how this aid, how these weapons are used in occupied territories and how that plays into this dynamic?
Really, I don't know enough information about which weapons are used, which were developed by Israel or not. But weapons are weapons. They are there to do what they're meant to do. They're meant to cause harm and to kill people. So, but I think that if I repeat to your question about the change from within, I think that maybe what his visit and his speech could do or did, it is yet to be seen, is to remind us that all of what we experience is not destiny. It's not from above, that the will of the people can change the government, can change its policy. And I think that this was his message, that this is why he insisted on talking directly to the public and not in the parliament, in the Knesset, and not just to the leaders.
Hada Ziv is Public Outreach Director for Physicians for Human Rights. She joined us from Tel Aviv. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hi there, this is Eric Kovner, News Director at KWVA Eugene, the University of Oregon's campus radio station. We rely on Free Speech Radio News to bring our campus and the wider community in-depth coverage of stories important to them about human rights and social justice issues. Our listeners count on FSRN each weekday to bring them the stories and voices that provide them with a vital link to the world. FSRN is an investment in independent media. But FSRN is currently facing a financial crisis and could be silenced. To learn more about this program and find out how you can help keep these voices on the airwaves, visit fsrn.org.
The House of Representatives narrowly passed the Paul Ryan budget today despite every Democrat and 10 Republicans voting against it. The plan converts Medicare to a voucher program and cuts trillions of dollars of government spending. It also seeks to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. But environmental activists have been mobilizing this week against the cross-country tar sands pipeline, targeting the companies who are bankrolling the project and are set to profit from its construction. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
No more theft of indigenous land! No pipeline! No tar sands! No more theft of indigenous land!
No pipeline!
Holding a paper pipeline reading No Keystone XL, a few dozen protesters marched outside the Canadian Embassy in Washington, which sits just a few blocks from Capitol Hill. Indigenous activist Louise Thundercloud said she hoped to send a message to Canadian and U.S. officials to stop lobbying for a project that would violate the rights and health of First Nations communities.
Indigenous people have long been easily sacrificed. We are the acceptable risk of this country as well as Canada and anywhere else that has been colonized. This pipeline not only violates all of our treaties as Indigenous people, it threatens all of our lives, but on a larger scope, it threatens the very lives of all humanity.
Though actions across the country this week have been targeting the companies investing in the pipeline and the refineries that would receive the tar sands oil, the final decision on the project's permit rests with President Obama and the U.S. State Department. Environmental activist Sarah Massey says she's hopeful the president will reject TransCanada's proposal.
This is not good for our country. A pipeline, a leaky pipeline through the heartland, the destruction of the tar sands space, is going to hurt our future, and we want a different future. And I believe he wants a good future for his family and the rest of us. He knows that the future for our country and for the rest of the world is going to come from clean energy, and he's working to get us there.
Yet despite President Obama's repeated promises to address climate change, his policies have increased fossil fuel production in the U.S., allowing more oil and gas drilling on public land and offshore, and fast-tracking the construction of the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. the makeup of his second-term cabinet promises more of the same. His latest nominee to run the Department of the Interior, Sally Jewell, worked for many years on oil pipelines in Alaska, Oklahoma, and Colorado, then served as a banker for nearly two decades before running the recreation equipment store REI. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee overwhelmingly voted to advance her nomination Thursday, sending the decision to the full Senate. Just before the vote, Louisiana Democrat Mary Landrieu praised the president for choosing a nominee with a background in fossil fuels.
It really is encouraging to me that we have a nominee that actually has spent some time in the oil and gas arena, that's fracked a well, that is a geologist, that understands the importance and the value and the promise of mining the resources that the United States has, but with the balance of her passion for the outdoor industry of which she's represented for many years.
But the vote was not unanimous. Several Republicans voted no, saying they aren't confident Jewell will support the fossil fuel industry. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso cited her past work protecting national parks as a reason she shouldn't be confirmed.
I am troubled by her lack of transparency in regards to her previous leadership of the National Parks Conservation Association. During her tenure as vice chairman of that group, NPCA has frequently sued the federal government to shut down energy production and has sought aggressive regulations that threaten American jobs.
Sally Jewell has also received several environmental awards, including the Rachel Carson Award from the Audubon Society in 2009. The Senate is expected to vote on her confirmation in the coming weeks. Alice Holstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
17% of all employed women in Argentina are domestic workers, according to the country's Ministry of Labor. Like domestic workers in the U.S. and other countries, many of them suffer from harsh working conditions. Those include low wages, long hours, and no paid maternity leave or compensation for workplace accidents. But their situation is about to change. Across Argentina, they unionized and lobbied national legislators who just passed a law that will afford them greater protection. From Buenos Aires, FSRN's Eilish O'Neill has more.
Maria Luisa Guedea works in a long-term youth hostel. Her job includes cleaning six bathrooms and three kitchens, as well as the bedrooms, every time one traveler leaves and another moves in. She says she's getting tired, but she doesn't know when she'll be able to retire.
Because of my age, it's already hard to do this work. I am 50 years old, you know. I am not 30 anymore. It's not the same.
Another Argentine domestic worker, Carmen Gonzalez, first started cleaning houses and taking care of children when she was 13 years old. Now, she's a single mother of five children, four of whom still live at home, and she struggles to make ends meet.
On weekdays, I work in three places. I leave my house at 7 a.m. and get back at 9:30 p.m. I go to bed at 2 in the morning, sometimes at 1. But at 6 in the morning, I'm already on my feet again so I can leave my house in order. One note for the nanny, another note for my children, so that they can take care of the little ones.
Gonzalez says she earns 20 pesos an hour, or about $4, which is below minimum wage. She knows other workers who make even less. In fact, domestic workers throughout Argentina experience harsh working conditions. According to the Ministry of Labor, though over 90% of domestic workers in Argentina are women, until now they had no guarantee of paid maternity leave. And though domestic workers registered with Argentina's social security system can get retirement benefits and paid sick leave, the Ministry of Labor estimates that two-thirds of the country's domestic workers are paid under the table and therefore have no protections at all. Carmen Gonzalez learned this the hard way. She was working full-time for one family, cleaning their house, caring for their three children, and cooking their lunches and dinners. One day, she woke up too sick to go to work.
When I told them I wasn't going to come because I was sick, they told me, just drop by for your pay. And so I felt, you can imagine. No, I told them, but how? I said, I'm really sick. I have a doctor's certificate and everything. I was kind of part of the family, you know. I had been working there for more than 3 years. No, they told me, servants aren't family.
The situation of domestic workers in Argentina mirrors that of domestic workers throughout the world, says Martin Ulz of the International Labour Organization.
Roughly half of the world's domestic workers do not benefit from a minimum wage set by law. At the same time, roughly half of the world's domestic workers do not have a legal entitlement to have even a weekly rest day or to have their weekly hours limited. Roughly one third of domestic workers don't have the right to maternity leave and associated cash benefits.
Utz adds that the situation of migrant domestic workers can be particularly precarious, especially if they don't speak the language of their adopted country, if they're unfamiliar with the culture or with the rights guaranteed by law, or if they're undocumented and fear deportation. Union organizer Manuela Munoz says migrant domestic workers in Argentina are often victims of human trafficking.
When employers hire a foreigner that they know doesn't have her paperwork in order, they hire her with the intention of not paying her what she deserves. So now we are talking about human trafficking.
Workers' rights advocates say these conditions can be changed through legislation. The International Labour Organization has written a convention on domestic workers, which Uruguay, Italy, Mauritius, and the Philippines have adopted. Again, Martin Ulz.
Brazil has included domestic workers in social security, not only for maternity protection, but for health and for pensions, etc. Uruguay has adopted a law regulating domestic work that sets out the labor protections and social security, and also has opened the country's collective bargaining and wage council system to domestic workers.
Protections like these are exactly what union organizer Manuela Munoz and others fought for and have finally won in Argentina. On March 13th, legislators passed a law that requires the employers of domestic workers to register them with the country's social security system. As a result, the workers will become eligible for benefits such as retirement, paid sick leave. The law also grants them 3 months of paid maternity leave, while before they had none, and requires employers to give students time off for classes and exams. Domestic worker Carmen Gonzalez says the legislation is important because it recognizes the value of domestic work.
I love what I do. I love cleaning. I love going around the houses. I love making my employers happy. But as I do my work well, I like it if they pay me and value me as I deserve.
The employers of domestic workers have 180 days from when the bill was signed into law to register their employees with the country's social security system. The law requires that employers register employees from their first day of work so their years of service can be used to calculate retirement and severance pay. Alicia O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, and to find out how you can support grassroots independent journalism, visit us online at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.